another from Droned, who says, "This Pac-Man is a joke. I cannot wait till this economy is in World War III and see what third gender he wants to talk about." I don't talk about third. We barely talk about gender on this show. And I also, while I don't make economic predictions typically, my expectation is inflation has peaked and will start to decline, and that we are getting closer to the stock market bottom. Now, obviously, that's kind of meaningless. We're always one day closer to the bottom, even if we're not there yet. But I don't even know what this person's talking about. And lastly, Claude wrote in, "This Pac-Man guy is just a mouthpiece for the Biden gang. What a joke. Imagine how much education was wasted to create this propagandist liar." The one thing I don't think you can say about this show is that we're mouthpieces for the Biden gang. In fact, I find Biden pretty uninspiring, and he's done, you know, three or four good things and is otherwise exactly what I expected his administration to be. So maybe you're thinking of another show, Claude, with respect. Send in your emails to info@davidpacman.com. We have a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Folks, glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a once-over.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
WRCT, the in sound from way out.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
With your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
So what we have to understand is just what we've seen at the Supreme Court level, this attack that's finally reached its pinnacle up to the Supreme Court to dismantle Roe v. Wade, this work has had tentacles, and it's been working to criminalize women and also to impose civil punishments associated with pregnancy.
Today, a Democracy Now! Special. As the Supreme Court appears set to overturn Roe v. Wade, we speak with law professor Michelle Goodwin, author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. We'll also talk about inclusive language around pregnancy with Chase Strangio, the ACLU's Deputy Director for Trans Justice, and look at escalating attacks on the LGBTQ plus community.
This is all happening in the same context that we're seeing the criminalization of abortion care, that we're continuing to see the massive suppression of votes across the country, and all of these things are interconnected and creating chaos and fear.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a Democracy Now! Special. The Supreme Court appears poised to overturn abortion rights. Earlier this month, Politico published a leaked Supreme Court draft opinion, which showed the court is set to overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark decision that's guaranteed federal constitutional protections of abortion rights for a half a century. If Roe is overturned, 13 states have so-called trigger laws that would make abortion illegal as soon as the court rules. Another 13 are expected to enact abortion bans soon after the court issues its ruling, in the case known as Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health. It was on the eve of the court's oral arguments in the Dobbs case in November that law professor Michelle Goodwin wrote a guest essay in the New York Times. It was headlined, "I Was Raped by My Father, An Abortion Saved My Life." I recently interviewed Michelle Goodwin. I began by quoting from her article, a warning to our viewers and listeners. This segment includes descriptions of sexual violence. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments on the constitutionality of a 15-week abortion ban in Mississippi that provides no exceptions in cases of rape or incest. What's at stake in this case matters to the countless girls and women who have been raped, including those who, like me, were raped by a father, an uncle, or another family member. It was the early morning of my 10th birthday, the first time I was raped by my father. It would not be the last. The shock was so severe, I temporarily went blind before I began the fifth grade a few weeks later. By the time the school year began, my father had taken me to see a battery of doctors. A medical explanation would paper over the fact that the trauma caused by his sexual violence had caused my body to shut down. The physiological suffering that I endured included severe migraines, hair loss, and even gray hair at 10 years old. While other girls may have longed for puberty, I loathed the idea of it. My body became a vessel that was not mine. It had been taken from me. I lived in fear of the night and the footsteps outside my bedroom door. Those are the opening words of Michelle Goodwin's New York Times guest essay last November, headlined, "I Was Raped by My Father, An Abortion Saved My Life." Again, written on the eve of the court's decision that could overturn the constitutional right to abortion. Michelle Goodwin joins us now. She's Chancellor's Professor at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy, and has written the book Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Professor Goodwin, welcome back to Democracy Now! We appreciate you joining us again this week. Can you start off by talking about why you chose to write that essay?
Amy, it's important that we all understand that the new aspect of anti-abortion provisions includes an aspect that we would not have seen even 5 years ago, and that is that they make no exceptions for cases of rape or incest. Now, these laws on their own are really quite chilling and horrific when we understand, just as a baseline, the importance of reproductive liberty and freedom, and when we understand that a woman or girl is 14 times more likely to die by carrying a pregnancy to term than by an abortion in the United States. So that's just a baseline anyway. But then when we add on to it that these laws have this kind of punitive aspect as well, such that if you have been raped or that you have somehow survived incest, that you too may no longer have an exception that would provide for the ability to terminate a pregnancy, then we really understand that these laws have nothing to do, and they never have had anything to do with protecting, respecting the autonomy, the dignity, the privacy of women or girls. In fact, they're just simply cruel types of laws that are power plays that fit into a history of controlling women's bodies and a history quite specifically of controlling the bodies of Black and brown women. I mean, it's been all women who've been subjected to the cruelties of such laws, but they have a particularly pernicious effect when we actually understand the historical implications too. As to rape and incest, I thought it was really important to legitimize that conversation and move us away from the taboo where we're not supposed to talk about those things, and where clearly the Supreme Court is not talking about that at all, as it was not raised in oral arguments. And in the leaked draft opinion that was circulated this week, Justice Alito does not even bother to actually mention rape or incest in any part of the nearly 100-page draft opinion.
When you talk about the health of African-American women, also the mortality rate, maternal mortality rate of African-American women, talk more, go more deeply into how these laws so deeply affect pregnant people all over the country, but particularly African-American women and low-income women.
That's right. I mean, as a general matter, we should all be horrified because, as a general matter, Black women are the canaries in the coal mine. What happens to them eventually reaches everybody else, though not always to the same degree. And that's also been historically true as well. As you look at states like Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, you know, as a national matter, Black women are nearly four times more likely to die than white women by carrying pregnancies to term, 3.5 times more likely. But when you drill that number down and you actually peer under the hood and you look in states such as I've mentioned, and you look even deeper within certain counties that have high populations of Black women, and you see then, well, in those places, Black women are 5, 10, 15, 17 times more likely to die by carrying pregnancies to term than their white counterpart. And if you look at that national statistic that I gave you, that women generally are 14 times more likely to die by carrying a pregnancy to term than an abortion, well, in Mississippi, it's over 100 times more likely to die. In fact, nearly 180 times more likely to die if you're a Black woman in Mississippi and you're coerced into carrying a pregnancy to term, you're that much more likely to die than by having an abortion. And so these alarming, really real alarming statistics that in any other category of health, if we heard that, the alarm bells would be ringing and the government would be saying, you know, don't choose the alternative at all. We want to keep you alive. But what's very interesting when it comes to pregnancy and pronatalism in this country, it's not about actually caring about the health of women, girls, people who can become pregnant. Not at all. Those alarm bells do not ring, even though the data that I've just shared with you comes from the CDC. It comes from the departments of health in these individual states. This is not data that's being made up by people who are pro-choice. This is data that we're getting from the governments in Florida and Texas. This is Governor Abbott's data that helps us to know that Texas is one of the most dangerous places in the entire developed world for a person to be pregnant.
I wanted to ask you about the Louisiana law. Well, it's not a law yet. It's been proposed that makes the destruction of a fertilized human egg at any stage of its development an act of murder, punishable, presumably, by Louisiana's death penalty. I mean, this is astounding. You're talking about—what about a person who works in a fertility clinic who is holding a test tube with a fertilized egg and drops that test tube? Could they be charged with murder?
Well, this is where we're in a space that I call the new Jane Crow. These laws that are not rational, they're quite illogical, and even more, they're punitive, they're cruel, they're absolutely excessive. You know, if you think about the work of Pauli Murray, she was in many ways the godmother of the civil rights movement. Thurgood Marshall said that the book that she wrote on race laws was the Bible of the civil rights movement. And it's about 800 pages, single space, all of these crazy, really crazy Jim Crow laws, such as, you know, black people can't play checkers in the park. That ridiculous that you think who in the world thought of that and would connect a fine and also criminal punishment if black people are caught playing checkers in the park. Well, in the new Jane Crow, we see laws such as, and propositions such as what you've just described. They make absolutely no sense, but they're absolutely cruel, and they're meant to cause fear and to chill behavior. And their reach is beyond what we could grasp or even imagine. And that's also really what policing the womb is about. It is a warning call because we've already seen, again, as black women in the canaries in the coal mine, we've seen that kind of punitive punishment with black women being dragged out of hospitals in shackles and chains in the late 1980s and 90s because they were imperfect in how they carried their pregnancies. No exact law saying that they could or should be dragged out of hospitals in such punitive ways or giving birth in prison and on toilets and concrete floors, but the specter of policing their pregnancies, this kind of specter that the state owns everything with regard to your reproductive capacities, leads us into a space where there's dramatic surveillance, and it's frightening for people, and that's what these laws are meant to do. Yes, they'll criminally punish and possibly even death sentence, but they're meant to instill fear in people.
I mean, you look at a most recent case that got a good amount of attention. It was the case of Lizelle Herrera. She is the Latinx woman in Texas who was charged with murder for, quote-unquote, a self-induced abortion. Now, because of groups like the Frontera Fund and women of color massively protesting, very much now that's the exception to the rule, and she was released and the charges were dropped. But if the Supreme Court rules as we think it will, based on this leak, this will become the rule of law.
Yes. Well, what we'll see is just like in Jim Crow times or antebellum times, there are places where women can be free and girls can be free and may not have to worry. And even there, I would put some caution around it, because in California, just a couple years ago in the Valley, there was a prosecutor who attempted to prosecute, in fact, was prosecuting a woman for murder in the case of her stillbirth. But yes, what we will begin to see is that there will be states where people will not be free, where they will, in fact, be policed. And that kind of policing will also be connected to sex profiling, just like racial profiling, right? This hyper-intensive look at what are girls and women doing with their bodies. There will be a turn to and pressure on nurses, on doctors, on medical staff to breach millennia-old practices of confidentiality between themselves and their patients, and they will breach that and will share that information, just as we saw in that case, with law enforcement. And then the next step will be arrest. And this is not just simply anecdotal. As I record in my book, in the state of Alabama already, there have been hundreds of women who have come under the inspection. of the state charged and arrested under fetal endangerment or child endangerment, in that case, laws that would extend child, the definition of a child, to a fetus. And in Alabama, as I've mentioned, Black women, canaries in the coal mine there, the majority of those women happen to be white, but they all are poor, or the vast majority of them were poor or working class women who've already come under the attention of the state in this prurient kind of way. So what we have to understand is just while we've seen at the Supreme Court level this attack that's finally reached its pinnacle up to the Supreme Court to dismantle Roe v. Wade, this work has had tentacles, and it's been working to criminalize women and also to impose civil punishments associated with pregnancy.
I wanted to ask you, Professor Goodwin, about the medication abortion, the pill. The LA Times lead story, "Abortion Pills, a Post-Roe Game Changer and the Next Battleground," the opening line, "The future of abortion in the U.S. is moving to the mailbox." It's also the front page story today of the New York Times. In abortion fight, pills could be the next focus. And it might surprise some people to know that more than half of abortions in the United States are result of taking these pills. You just did a podcast on this. Can you talk about this issue?
That's right. That's right. So in Europe, this has been liberalized for decades. And due to political machinations and with the Food and Drug Administration, which at times can be captured by outside sources, it was stalled in the United States. But now, for more than a decade, just about a decade in the United States, we have a significant number of pregnancy terminations, abortions, being done through medication. They're incredibly safe. The World Health Organization has compared an abortion to the safety of a penicillin shot. So these pills are very, very safe. It's worth noting that during the Trump administration, of over 22,000 drugs that one could receive in the mail during the height of COVID, medication, abortion, these pills were the only ones where a person had to go to a clinic, to a hospital in order to receive them. So there is a way in which they've been selected out for a different kind of treatment than any other kind of prescription. That said, they are accessible. And for people who are wondering now, women who are wondering now, what comes next? Well, these pills are accessible, and find a source where you are able to get them. And there are underground sources as well that are online, where folks are told this is how you order them, and they can be sent to a friend and they can get them to you. There are myriad ways of getting that done. But the attack will be exactly that. The attack will come to the mailbox in order to try to shut down access to abortion in every means possible, including not just shutting down the clinics where surgical abortions can take place, but also searching the mailbox in some form of a way. So we'll begin to see myriad laws being shaped that try to get at that, that makes it illegal to receive pills in the mail, that make it illegal to send pills in the mail and any other. I mean, it's amazing the kinds of innovations that these legislators can come up with to try to curb rights and dismantle rights. And they're not very good and not committed to actually saving the lives of people who actually end up pregnant, want to stay pregnant, or don't want to stay pregnant.
Professor Goodwin, in your book, Policing the Womb, you write, "Arguably, abortion has become so fundamentally intertwined linguistically and conceptually with the terminology of reproductive privacy and reproductive rights that little else fits within the taxonomy. This is a mistake," you write. Why?
Well, it's been a mistake when you think about the following. If you think about civil rights, that's a plural. It has an S on it. And as having an S on it, it means that we're not just talking about Brown v. Board of Education, right? We're talking about education, employment, housing, the ability to swim in the pool in your neighborhood and walk through the park. We're talking about accommodations in all of those areas. And when we center just one aspect within the abortion rights or within reproductive rights, then we're talking just about abortion, then we're missing sex education, access to contraception. We're missing conversations about sterilization. We're missing all of everything else. And that kind of blind spot then means a failure to pay attention to many of the other areas where there have already been encroachments on reproductive health rights and justice. And so this is why we've missed largely what's been happening to Black and Brown women, the kind of most horrific treatment by government during their pregnancies. This is how the agenda of personhood was missed in the 1980s and 90s when it was being inflicted on Black women. You know, when prosecutors are claiming that your embryo or your fetus is a living born child and it is not by any constitutional definition, then everybody should be alarmed. But in the 1980s and 90s, it completely missed those in the reproductive rights movement who were only focusing on abortion. But here's the other thing, Amy, given the histories of coercion and coercive reproduction in the United States that dates back to the forced kidnap and trafficking of Black women, then we should all be concerned about the fact that Black women for centuries in this country have not been accorded dignity when they are carrying pregnancies to term and when they're carrying pregnancies to term that they want. And we should want it all. We should want that women should be able to survive and have dignity when they are pregnant and want to be pregnant. And we should also care about government coercively forcing women to carry pregnancies that they don't want for the benefit of random state legislators that these women do not even know.
Michelle Goodwin is Chancellor's Professor at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. When we come back, I ask about her book, Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As I continue my conversation with Michelle Goodwin, Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine, I asked her about the leaked draft opinion to overturn Roe v. Wade, written by Justice Samuel Alito. In part of his ruling, Alito provides a list of anti-abortion laws from various U.S. states enacted between 1850 and 1919. When these laws were passed, women did not have the right to vote. Most African Americans were either legally enslaved or, after emancipation, subjected to racial terrorism and lynching at the hands of law enforcement and the Ku Klux Klan. In his rewriting of history, Justice Alito says traditions from these eras should dictate current law. I asked Professor Goodwin to talk about Alito's argument and the history she tells in her book, Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood.
That's right. It's a very interesting cherry picking, the kind of selectivity that Justice Alito brings to this, which in so many ways is also completely alarming. Alarming for the fact that it is not an accurate account. This draft opinion is stunning and alarming for what it omits. It is stunning for the citations that are chosen in it, and it's also historical erasures, and that's just to start, to just level start. So this period of time that he chooses to select ignores the period before, when abortions were not criminalized. The pilgrims performed abortions, indigenous people on whose lands we are doing this program, performed abortions in all myriad form of healthcare. There were, at that point, not men running around with stethoscopes and lab coats. Obstetrics and gynecology was not even a field at the founding of the United States. This period that he talks about is a period that leads up to the Civil War. It is a period of time in which abortion curiously becomes criminalized because 100%, nearly 100% of reproductive health care was being done by women. About half of those were Black women, and then there were indigenous women and white women, and these were the midwives. And the midwives, and if anyone thinks about it, well, that makes sense that 2,000 years ago, there weren't guys with stethoscopes and lab coats saying, I'm your gynecologist. It just simply did not exist, right? These were women doing the care and work for women. But in a period of time leading up to the Civil War, obstetrics and gynecology slowly becomes a field. And there are men like Horatio Storer and Joseph DeLee, and then there had been Marion Sims, a notoriously terroristic gynecologist who experimented on Black women and failed to even provide them, denied them pain relief, right? No anesthesia for them. He wrote in his autobiography, in fact, Amy, how he would have epiphanies in the middle of the night and then take his knives and other tools and literally cut into the bodies of Black women for his middle of the night experimentations and epiphanies. He's considered the godfather of gynecology. A statue was erected in his honor in Central Park, but I digress. But it's those guys who helped to lead a movement against midwives. And the way in which this movement takes shape is to say, well, they're doing something immoral, and that is abortion. It was not about abortions. It was about monopolizing a field. And they were successful at leveraging themselves to be able to push midwives out of reproductive health care, take over this field for themselves. I mean, between that period of time that he quotes, that Justice Alito quotes, and the beginning of the 20th century, we go from 100% of reproductive health care being done by midwives to 1% at the beginning of the 20th century. And what was used to do that was to criminalize abortion. And these were very strategic doctors, and I'll just add one more point to it. This was also so deeply racialized because they wrote about, their words not mine, about how white women needed to use their loins and go north, south, east, and west. It's this collection of doctors who pushed for anti-immigration campaigns against people who were coming from Asian countries. It's a period of our history that's worth unpacking, not just for reproductive rights, but for the racism and its intimacy with white supremacy.
Professor Goodwin, you write about policing and criminalization around abortion, but also around women who want to have children. Can you tell us the story, the highly disturbing story you describe in your book of Marlise Munoz in Texas?
Yes. I mean, when we think about this as, again, the plural of reproductive rights and begin to look beyond abortion, then we see the tactics that have been invested in by this anti-woman, anti-trans, and it's all together, and with a very specific focus on Black and brown women, but a reach that goes everywhere. Marlise Munoz was a healthcare worker. She was an EMT, and she had a brain aneurysm, and she was pregnant. She experienced brain death. Brain death is well-defined and has been well-defined and accepted for half a century in the United States. At the period of brain death, a person who has a do not resuscitate order would then not be resuscitated, allowed for the body to physically die and cremated or buried or whatever that person has decided, or the family members. But in Texas and in nearly three dozen states, there's what are called medical exclusion laws. The name doesn't necessarily tell us what substantively it does. Substantively, what it does is it takes away that kind of decision-making for a woman who is pregnant. So in Marlise's case, when she was rushed to the hospital officials decided that she should be on a life-sustaining treatment, only she was brain dead. Marlise's husband, Eric Munoz, and her parents said, we do not want her on life support. She is brain dead. We want to be able to, with dignity, have her life come to a close. Twice she was medically sustained. There was a tracheotomy that was performed. The hospital ultimately taped her eyes shut because it put her on a bed that violently rocked back and forth. There were pro-life protesters that came to the hospital and protested outside, saying that medical science didn't matter, that in a week, Marlise would be alive. For 62 days, Marlise's body was forced to be an incubator for a fetus that was not developing well at all. And against the will of her husband and her parents, they actually had to sue the state of Texas in order for Marlise to be released from the hospital and taken off of life support. She was dead. It is incontrovertible that brain death is death in the United States, except now if you happen to be pregnant person, a pregnant woman, then brain death somehow in these anti-abortion states means something different. And it is a tragic case in Marlise's case. Her father talked about how her skin had become so hard, her body had become so hard, it was like a mannequin touching her. The stench was so severe that it was hard for people to come into the room. But this is what the state of Texas is seeking to normalize.
We're talking with Professor Michelle Goodwin. The stories you tell in this book, like of Bebe Shui in Indiana, an immigrant woman from China who attempted suicide. If you can tell us her story, she was pregnant, and the fact that she was charged with murder.
Days before Christmas, a few years ago, Bebe Shui was in a parking lot, and her boyfriend threw money at her and told her that he was going away and never wanted to see her again. Distraught, Bebe Shui sought to kill herself. She got rat poison. And it's interesting to note that for women in China who are attempting to commit suicide, it's not unusual to use turn to pesticides and things like rat poison. Well, she ate six packets of rat poison in order to kill herself. She survived because her friends found her, rushed her to the hospital, where doctors engaged in very aggressive treatments to try to save Bebe Shui's life and to also try to preserve and save the fetus as well. Angel was her child that was born and survived for 4 days and then died. Doctors were not clear exactly why and how Angel died. Angel could have died because of the very aggressive life-sustaining treatments that they tried to provide. They didn't know. In any case, Bebe Shui was charged with first-degree murder. The prosecutors in the state of Indiana sought over 40 years of incarceration for Bebe Shui. They charged her with first-degree murder and also attempted feticide. At the time in which the laws for feticide were enacted in the state, legislators said this would never be used against women and that the purpose for them was actually to go after people, men, who beat up their girlfriends and wives during pregnancy. But that was not the case in Bebe Shui's scenario. And what's interesting to note there, Amy, is that in the state of Indiana, it's not a crime to attempt to commit suicide. It is not a crime. And yet prosecutors went after Bebe Shui as a pregnant person because she attempted to commit suicide while pregnant. And I want to just add one other piece to that, too, that really helps us to see just how cruel the punishment is. In years prior to that, in using this feticide law, prosecutors sought 3 years in connection with a woman being stabbed to death while pregnant by her boyfriend. 3 years in his case for what happened to the fetus. In a case involving a bank robber who robbed a bank and shot a teller in the belly twice, killing twins, it was 5 years. In Bebe Shui's case, 40 years. And I think that really helps to establish just what this policing means and how it is a very cruel and punitive turn towards control of women.
You also note, Professor Goodwin, that hospitals and hospital staff serve as surrogates of the state. I mean, I go back to the Lizelle Herrera case, the Latino woman in Texas who was charged with murder, who apparently went to the hospital and they said was dealing with a self-induced abortion. We don't know the details exactly, but it was clearly people in the hospital who— is believed were involved with talking to the state that got her charged. The charges were dropped because the public was so outraged by what happened to her, and this was very recent.
That's right. It's another example, and it's an important example, as to how doctors and nurses have essentially become snitches for the state. Not all doctors, but a significant enough number of them that in the state of Alabama, they kind of have a hotline relationship with prosecutors in that state. And I know this because I spent time in Alabama interviewing prosecutors in person and then also by phone interviewing them as to how are you coming to prosecute these women in your state connected with their pregnancies. And I was directly told it's because of the relationships that have been formed and built with nurses and doctors. And of course, this is the backdrop of the case involving the dozens of Black women in South Carolina, where the Medical University of South Carolina purposefully engaged in creating a dragnet with police and prosecutors so that they could explicitly and specifically target Black women who used crystallized cocaine during pregnancy. Now, for your audience to be clear, there is no statistical difference in terms of the rate of use of crystallized cocaine between Black women and white women at all. But the Medical University of South Carolina wanted to focus only on Black women. And in fact, in their dragnet, which included dozens of women literally being dragged out of their hospitals or shackled and chained during delivery, there's only one white woman who was implicated in their large and official dragnet. And that was a white woman on whose medical chart one of the head nurses wrote, lives with Negro boyfriend. And that was enough to get her lumped in with the Black women who were singled out for this kind of chilling and horrific treatment. And all of this is important to know, and all of this we would have seen if, in fact, there were broader attention paid to reproductive rights as a plural rather than as a singular item.
Professor Goodwin, at the end of your book, you write about a reproductive justice New Deal. Can you explain what your recommendations are?
Yes. We have to understand that in these times, nobody is really safe. This is really a backsliding of democracy. This is really a trampling of the rule of law in many ways. And if we had more time on it, we could talk about just how Justice Roberts fits into that. But
please
I write about... Okay. I write about a reproductive New Deal as the urgency of these times and recognizing that we're all vulnerable. People who are LGBTQ, as we see in Texas, have become vulnerable. In Florida, the Don't Say Gay legislation, which is now sweeping across the country, the attacks on parents and trans children in Texas. In this reproductive New Deal, I outline that there should be constitutional protections associated with the reproductive sphere, and in fact, with just simply the human sphere. And I delineate what all of that means step by step, much in relation to just the kind of arc that we've talked about on your show this morning. Across all of these areas, we need to think about protecting people who can become pregnant and seeing those as fundamental constitutional rights all along. And we don't have an Equal Rights Amendment, and this is a means of explicitly getting at these various areas in which legislators have sought to basically strip away any form of human dignity, privacy, autonomy, and equality from anybody who has the potential to become pregnant. And we are largely talking about women and girls.
That's Michelle Goodwin, Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine, author of the book Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. We turn now to Democratic Congressmember Lucy McBath of Georgia. During a recent meeting of the House Judiciary Committee, she shared her personal story about accessing reproductive care.
Like so many women in America, for years, I struggled to get pregnant. My husband and I, we tried everything that we could do to start a family of our own, and finally, we were successful. I had never been so happy, and I prayed for this moment for so many years. I wanted to tell everyone. I just wanted to shout it from all of the mountaintops. For weeks, I began to dream about our life and our future together. And then one day, I woke up covered in blood. It's hard to describe the agony of a miscarriage. It's heartbreak. It's helplessness. It's pain, and it's profound sadness. Millions of women suffer from them, and I've heard from many who felt guilty like I did, who felt as though that we weren't worthy of having a child. Those are the same feelings that crept through my mind, and every time I've had these difficult discussions with other women, I remind them that they are strong and that they are powerful beyond measure, and that their worth is far more than their ability to procreate. However, it seems those in support of this ruling disagree. After my second miscarriage, I wondered in my grief again if God had decided I was never meant to be a mother. So when I finally got pregnant again, I was overjoyed. It was as if I believed that God was giving me and my husband, finally, he had a plan for us to be parents. But after 4 months, while feeling terror and trauma in my heart, I was rushed to the emergency room. There with my doctor and my husband, I learned that I had suffered a fetal demise or a stillbirth. There again, I was filled with anguish and sorrow and guilt, and I tried so hard, and still I felt like I failed trying to be a mother. My doctor thought it would be better to and safer to end the pregnancy naturally without the medicines so commonly used. So for 2 weeks, I carried my dead fetus and waited for me to go into labor. For 2 weeks, people passed me on the street, telling me how beautiful I looked, asking how far along I was, and saying that they were so excited for me and my future with my child. For 2 weeks, I carried a lost pregnancy and the torment that comes with it. I never went into labor on my own. When my doctor finally induced me, I faced the pain of labor without hope for a living child. This is my story. It's uniquely my story. And yet, it's not so unique. Millions of women in America, women in this room, women at your homes, and women you love and cherish have suffered a miscarriage. And so I ask, on behalf of these women, after which failed pregnancy should I have been imprisoned? Would it have been after the first miscarriage? After doctors used what would be an illegal drug to abort the lost fetus? Would you have put me in jail after the second miscarriage? Perhaps that would have been the time. Forced to reflect in confinement at the guilt I felt, the guilt that so many women feel after losing their pregnancies. Or would you have put me behind bars after my stillbirth? After I was forced to carry a dead fetus for weeks, after asking God if I was ever going to be able to raise a child, and I asked because the same medicine used to treat my failed pregnancies is the same medicine states like Texas would make illegal. I ask because if Alabama makes abortion murder, does it make miscarriage manslaughter? I ask because I want to know if the next woman who has a miscarriage at 3 months, if she will be forced to carry her dead fetus to term. So for the women in your life,
whose stories you do not know, for the women across the country whose lives you may not understand, and for the women in America who have gone through things you simply cannot comprehend, I say to you this. Women's rights are human rights. Reproductive health care is health care. And medical decisions should be made by women and those that they trust, not politicians and officials. We have a choice. We can be the nation that rolls back the clock, that rolls back the rights of women, and that strips them of their very liberty. Or we can be the nation of choice, the nation where every woman can make her own choice. Freedom is our right to choose.
That was Georgia Congressmember Lucy McBath. A year after her stillbirth, she gave birth to her son, Jordan Davis. In 2012, Jordan was shot dead by a white man over a dispute about loud music in a gas station on a Thanksgiving weekend in Jacksonville, Florida. Jordan was just 17 years old. Before joining Congress, Lucy McBath became a leading advocate for gun control. When we come back, we'll talk to Chase Strangio about inclusive language around pregnancy. He is the ACLU's Deputy Director for Trans Justice, and we'll look at the escalating attacks on the LGBTQ community. Stay with us. Young This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major development in the ongoing attacks on the lives of transgender people in the United States, Alabama has become the first state in the nation to pass a law to make it a felony to provide gender-affirming medical care to trans youth. The law went into effect May 8th, but it's been partially blocked by a federal judge. The law aims to ban the use of puberty blockers and hormones, which can be life-saving for trans children and teens. Doctors and others who are found in violation of the law could face up to 10 years in prison in Alabama. Just after Alabama enacted the law, I spoke to Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Trans Justice with the ACLU LGBTQ and HIV Project.
I mean, this is just a really devastating and terrifying time on so many levels. And with Alabama's law, this is a law that's been introduced in Alabama since 2020. We've been able to block it in 2020 and 2021, and they continue to move it forward. Unfortunately, on the last day of the legislative session, it was pushed through. It was immediately signed by the governor. It had an emergency effective date, which meant there was only 30 days from the time it was signed by Governor Ivey in Alabama to when it went into effect, creating an absolute terrifying sea change in the reality on the ground for trans people, their families, and their doctors in Alabama, and not just in Alabama, but across the Southeast. The University of Alabama has a gender clinic that is serving trans adolescents and their families, not just in Alabama, but in Georgia and Florida and Tennessee and Mississippi. And now, in a matter of hours, all of that care is is becoming a felony, which means families are uprooting their lives. They're trying to figure out when and whether they can get life-saving care for their adolescent children. And I think it's important to note that this is all happening in the same context that we're seeing the criminalization of abortion care, that we're continuing to see the massive suppression of votes across the country. And all of these things are interconnected and creating chaos and fear among individuals, families, and communities across 50% of the country at least, because we are looking at a situation where come June, we're going to have an absolute sea change in the realities of our federal constitutional rights, which is going to lead to actions by the states that are going to continue this type of escalation that we're seeing in Alabama and elsewhere.
Chase, let's talk more about the content of this Alabama law and other similar laws, such as the executive directive that was issued by the Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott, which orders the Department of Family and Protective Services in that state to conduct child abuse investigations into parents who give gender-affirming care to their trans children. The Texas directive is now on hold. A major new report published last week by the Yale Law School, the Yale School of Medicine, and the University of Texas Southwestern notes, quote, Texas and Alabama officials have falsely claimed that doctors are routinely sterilizing children and teenagers with surgical procedures. It also says both states, quote, consistently ignore the mainstream scientific evidence that documents the substantial benefits of gender-affirming care, greatly exaggerate the risks of gender-affirming drug therapy, and rely on poor quality evidence, unquote. One of the co-authors of the report, Meredith McNamara of the Yale School of Medicine and Child Study Center, said, quote, we need to call for fact-based checks on legal opinions and legislation. Scientists need to have a seat at the table, and perhaps most importantly, there must be a penalty for writing fake science into law. Trans and non-binary youth are facing the fight of their lives to simply exist, and we can't let them stand alone. This is a matter of life and death, she said. Chase, your response, and talk about the significance of this Yale Medical School report.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. This is so important that we have accountability, that we have fact-checked. And it is true that these laws are codifying complete misinformation and outright lies about this care. Young people are not being forcibly sterilized when it comes to gender-affirming care. They are being forcibly sterilized in many circumstances when it comes to the non-consensual surgeries on intersex infants that are explicitly allowed under these laws. But we have to be clear about what's happening. And it's not just Republican lawmakers that are codifying this misinformation. The public discourse, the media is all complicit in this because we have spent the last 5 years and more having a debate, a so-called debate over the legitimacy of trans life that has allowed these types of laws to flourish. And the reality is that this care is safe, this care is effective. You have 21 medical groups weighing in court in Texas, in Alabama, saying these laws must be enjoined. This is safe medical care that we have used for decades. This is effective medical care that we know to save the lives of adolescents. And by the way, this care is only provided to adolescents. They talk about children, but this is treatment that is provided to people once they have reached puberty. It is already incredibly difficult to access. There are long waiting lines. There are long wait list. It can be cost prohibitive already for many families. And the reality is that there are conservative protocols in place that govern the provision of this care through very strictly regulated medical protocols. We're talking about a situation where parents are consenting, adolescents are consenting, and the doctors are recommending this treatment. And it is treatment that is well studied, it is well provided, and it has documented benefits for these young people. But instead of recognizing that, we're in a situation with the escalated criminalization of this care. In the case of Texas, we have the governor directing the Department of Protective Service to investigate families. Thankfully, that is on hold. And then we have Alabama that is now criminalizing this care in the context of the provision of the care by parents and doctors up to the age of 19. And as we're talking about the ages here, I think it's really important to note that Republican legislatures across the country continue to creep the age later and later. So we hear the discourse of children, but Missouri, for example, has proposed legislation that would block this care up to age 25. The reality is that it's not about protecting children. It's not about protecting anyone. It's about surveilling and criminalizing trans bodies and making this medical care increasingly out of reach because we're continuing to see the propagation of this misinformation about what this care actually is.
Finally, Chase, I wanted to talk to you about this historic week around abortion, the leaked draft opinion that the Supreme Court's going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And I want to talk about both abortion and gender-affirming care. We reported earlier that Florida's Republican Senator Marco Rubio introduced a bill Friday that would prohibit employers from deducting expenses related to their employees' travel costs when seeking gender-affirming care for their children out of state, as well as for those seeking an abortion. So if you can talk about what often in this last week hasn't been talked about as much because, the abortion issue has been preeminent, why it's important to talk about trans care at the same time, and if you can also talk about inclusive language around pregnancy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you look at the reality of how specifically the right has systematically over the last 50 years used state legislatures and the federal judiciary to slowly expand the power of the state to control people's reproductive choices and erode the federal constitutional right to access abortion, that very playbook is being utilized to constrain much more than access to abortion. It's being used to constrain access to contraception. It's being used to constrain access to the restroom if you're a trans person. It's being used to constrain access to healthcare for transgender adolescents. And the reality is that the animating goal behind all of these pieces of legislation is to control people's bodies, to enforce codes and norms of gender and sexuality that entrench power in the hands of the state, that enforce a heterosexual Christian nuclear family as the only model that is part of a state-building project, by the way. And so if we don't connect these things, we are ultimately going to see the erosion of all of our rights. If you look at something like SB 8 in Texas, which went into effect months ago, that type of legislation that creates a bounty provision where private citizens are deputized by the government to surveil and criminalize and enforce criminal penalties against their neighbors, that is exactly what's happening to trans young people and their families in Texas and elsewhere. And then you look at the expansion of these criminal penalties in proposed legislation where we're starting to see efforts to criminalize people for going out of state to access the healthcare that they need in the abortion context, in the trans context. These are part and parcel of the very same playbook. The same lawmakers that are introducing the anti-abortion legislation are introducing the anti-trans bills in the same committees, in the same states. It is all part of the same strategy to enforce norms of gender, enforce norms of sexuality that limit people's reproductive autonomy and ability to self-determine their identities. And the reality is that we have failed to mobilize collectively, and we have let the right divide us, which has been very effective for them and very unfortunate for us, because we're looking at a situation now where we are going to see a Supreme Court that is ready and willing to erode not just the constitutional right to access abortion, but that right to access contraception, the right to access marriage equality, the right to determine whether and how we can access health care generally, when that health care is about affirming who we are. So we should have a lot of questions for ourselves in these movements about how we're going to fight back collectively and not rely on the discourse that the state is setting forth that is set up to divide us. And when it comes to language and sort of the distraction of inclusive language in the public conversation, you can see you have this opinion leaked early in the week, last week, where this is devastating for the future of so many people's ability to survive and access safe medical care. And then you have some people focusing on the fact that on occasion we recognize that some people who are not women become pregnant. We may use the language of pregnant people. We may use the language of birthing people. That is just a fact. And the reality is women are people, by the way, and people may become pregnant who are not women. That we acknowledge reality on occasion to, hold space for people like me who are not women who may become pregnant, that's just a factual truth. It allows people to have more access to care. It allows a more robust movement that lets more people in, which is always to the benefit of everyone. But we're not out here saying that we shouldn't talk about women. People can still talk about women. These laws target women. There is an important conversation to be had about the systematic attack on women's opportunities, on the regulation of women's bodies. The reality is such, though, that it's not just women who are affected. And by the way, the more we have this non-inclusive discourse, it's not just trans men and non-binary people who are excluded. It's the entire system of gender-based policing that is then invisibilized, because this harms all of us, and we all have a role to play in fighting back.
That's Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Trans Justice with the ACLU LGBTQ and HIV Project. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Mary Conlin, and Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder Radio, we talk to progressive San Francisco District Attorney Chase Aboudin, who is facing a politicized recall election on June the 7th.
Tens of millions of dollars are pouring in, used against Chase to get rid of him, because if they can get rid of him, they can get rid of all the other progressive prosecutors across the country.
We'll also be speaking with Joe Lauria, editor-in-chief of Consortium News, which has just lost its funding through PayPal.
Is this worse than McCarthyism? Is there government involvement? What does this mean for the future of free journalism?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. 2 years ago, attorney Chase Aboudin was elected by the people of San Francisco to reform the criminal justice system in their city. He was specifically chosen to begin reversing the mass incarceration, which has been happening since the 1970s. This mass incarceration was a reaction by right-wing forces to the civil rights movement. By the time Chase was elected, 2.3 million U.S. citizens were behind bars across the country, and another 6 million were on probation or parole. The United States has the highest per capita number of people incarcerated and under governmental supervision than any country in the world. Chase promised to begin to reverse this outrage. As an opponent of mass incarceration, his campaign emphasized that half the people arrested in San Francisco are either addicted to drugs or mentally ill or both. He developed diversion programs. He got people into drug rehabilitation and/or psychiatric counseling. He emphasized caring not only for those arrested for crimes, but especially for their victims. He sought to and succeeded in making San Francisco a safer city. Now, after 2 years of Chase's service, crime in San Francisco has largely decreased. As Chesa promised, his office has prosecuted police for misconduct and corporate criminals for white-collar crimes. Right-wing big money forces from outside San Francisco are attempting to recall Chesa Boudin. The vote will take place on June 7th, and early voting has already begun. Rich people who don't even live in San Francisco have played a big role in the campaign. The right-wing strategy for the recall is the use of fear. Fear of change, fear of crime, fear of minorities, fear of unsheltered people living in the streets. Chesa grew up while both of his parents, David Gilbert and Kathy Boudin, who died on May 1st, were in prison serving long terms. He was raised by friends of his parents, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, two professors who adopted him and welcomed him into their blended family. As a young boy, he would fly alone to visit his parents and go through the prison metal detector to have a few hours with them in the visiting room. Chesa is one of a number of progressive district attorneys